We'll commence with this rain report for the week of September 12th, 2008, in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome to the rain report. I'm Byron Lee, KC9EEK. If you haven't already done so, it's time to go to therainreport.com and subscribe to the weekly rain podcast, especially starting this week. I'm Byron Lee, KC9EEK. This week, we begin a new monthly series Rain's founder-producer Hap Holly, KC9RP, has dubbed Ham Radio Roots, a look at how various ham operators, famous and otherwise, got into this crazy service. Our first is Rich Mosesen, W2VU, editor of CQ Magazine and holder of operating awards including DXCC, CQ, DX, CQ DX Field, and WPX.
I got involved in the radio hobby through Boy Scouts, and I guess even earlier, listening to AM broadcast band, listening to faraway stations at night. The whole concept of hearing things at night that I couldn't hear during the day was fascinating to me. Then my scoutmaster was very active in CB radio, and this was back in the mid to late 1960s, when CB was a much friendlier place than it became in later years. He got my dad and me, along with a bunch of other kids who were in the troop, involved in CB. Had a very good time with that. And then a friend of mine in high school, as I was getting into high school, had gotten interested in ham radio and was working on his license and dragged me along to a radio club meeting because he knew that I had some interest in radio in general. And they had just started a radio club in my high school with two or three licensed hams. And I distinctly remember that first meeting I went to. One of the kids had brought a shortwave receiver with him, and we met in a classroom on the second floor, and he hooked a roll of wire to the back of the radio and tossed the other end out the window, plugged in the radio and turned it on. The very first thing we tuned in was Radio Tirana in Albania. And even though I was still in high school, I knew that Albania in the late 1960s, early 1970s, was one of the most closed societies on Earth, and that it was very, very difficult to get any information to or from Albania at that time. It's kind of like trying to communicate with North Korea today. And here they were, talking to us. I was hooked, instantly. It's highly addictive. I've never found a cure for it, not that I've tried very hard. But that was my introduction to shortwave listening and through the radio club to ham radio as well. Scouting was still playing a mix in there because I remember getting my novice license so that I wouldn't have to take the code test twice. I was working on Radio Merit Badge, which required that you basically pass a code test, and you were exempted from that requirement if you had an FCC amateur license. So I figured, why take the test twice if I can take it once and make it count for both? That was one of my direct motivations in getting my license when I did, which was late 1970, so that I could not have to take the code test twice. A fascinating thing that I learned in later years was that my Radio Merit Badge counselor was Arnie Trossman, W2DTJ, who at the time had just started a new job after serving several years as editor of CQ Magazine. He never mentioned that to me at the time, or if he did, it passed right over. It's been one of those only in ham radio coincidences that one of the first people who introduced me to the hobby turns out to be predecessor of mine in the job that I hold today.
That's wild. Tell me about your first rig.
First of all, I went for at least the first year with borrowed radios. According to my log, I had a DX20 that I borrowed from somebody, a Heathkit DX20, a Hallicrafters SX99 receiver that my uncle had loaned me. He had been a novice once in the late 50s or early 60s and let his license lapse, but he still had a receiver stuck in a closet someplace. After that, I went through a variety of borrowed transmitters. This was, of course, before really the transceiver days. I borrowed an Ico 720 and a homebrew transmitter that a friend of mine had built. He eventually bought from a friend of mine who was upgrading to a single sideband transmitter, Hallicrafters HT40, which was CW and AM, and of course at the time I couldn't use the AM. Then I eventually graduated into a Lafayette HA350 receiver. I was in college already when I got that radio. So that SX99 did me well for a while. Then when I got on VHF, I got a Heathkit Tour. Eventually put the HT40 to use on 6-meter AM. Was able to make a good number of contacts on there.
What got you interested in 2 meters?
Failing a code test. When I had my novice, it was in the days when it was a two-year license that was non-renewable, and also in the days before volunteer examining. And when I thought I was ready to upgrade to general, I went down to the FCC in New York City and took the code test and failed it by two letters. I will always remember that. You had to copy 65 letters, and I had 63. The lovely gentleman there would not let me take it again, not without waiting a month. But he did say, why don't you take the written test and get that out of the way, and at least you get your technician if you pass that, and you'll have a permanent license. You won't have to worry about the license going away. So I did that and passed. The problem at that time was that technicians did not have novice privileges. So I was completely off of the HF bands, couldn't build up my code speed because there was virtually no code activity on VHF. So I was on VHF by default. A friend of mine had available a Heathkit Tour and an 8-element beam, as I recall. I don't know why it was 8 elements, because most beams that I'm familiar with today are odd number of elements, but this was an 8-element beam. 5 watts AM, vibrator motor supply for the car, a pair of stacked Squalo antennas for the car, too. I still have the Tour sitting on a shelf. I haven't turned it on in years. And I still have the Squalo, which works quite well. The rest of it has died. But that got me on 2 meter AM. January of 72, I got my technician.
Now, you said the novice lasts for 2 years.
When it was first introduced, it was a one-year non-renewable license. Then at some point in the mid to late 60s, they changed it to a two-year non-renewable license. And it stayed that way, I believe, until 79, when they made a lot of changes, including giving novice privileges to technicians and things like that. The time that I had it in the early 1970s, it was a two-year license.
As you were looking at your log in front of you, were there any early contacts that stood out?
Well, the first one, of course, was with WA3JYO in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And I, interestingly, made mention in an editorial a few years ago of that contact that, you know, kind of you always remember your first contact. And he got back in touch with me. That was really cool after about 30 years. Fair number of local contacts. I did a lot of on-air talking with friends locally for practice as much as anything else. Early DX contacts stood out, of course. First one, I believe, is in Canada. But beyond that, there's nothing that really jumps out at me.
When you got your ticket, did you find yourself being on the air as much as you could?
Yeah, definitely. But as today, that was limited. I was in school. I had homework to do. I had other activities to be involved with, so I couldn't be on all the time. But I spent as much time as I could on the air, for sure.
I'm speaking today with Rich Moses of W2VU, the editor of CQ Magazine, and we're talking about his early days in amateur radio as part of the Ray and Ham Radio Roots series. We'll be right back. This is the Ray Report. Did amateur radio have something to do with your career as a writer?
Oh, it had everything to do with my career, and it was based on a hoax. My high school, the principal was very competitive, not with us, but with other districts. A high school in a neighboring town had gotten a license to put a 10-watt FM station on the air. Since we in the radio club were the only ones who knew anything about radio at all, he called us into his office and said, people at this school have gotten a FCC license for an educational FM station. I want you to look into getting one for us. I was secretary of the club at the time, so I was the one who wrote the FCC for information. I got back an inch and a half thick stack of papers, and I got as far as the $7,500 filing fee. Since we had about $75 in our treasury, completely out of the question. Plus, of course, you had to tell them what equipment you were going to use, and we had no idea what equipment we might use. So we went back to the principal and said, there's no way we can do this. It costs $7,500 just to send them the papers. And he said, well, isn't there something you can do? Well, we, of course, saw this as carte blanche to do anything short of burning down the school. And we built a fake radio station, had some old airport transmitter that had been donated to us that didn't work, and we hollowed everything out, but wired up the lights to the switches and the fan, brought in a couple of tape recorders, and somebody had an old turntable, a dead broadcast-style microphone that we hollowed out and shoved a tape recorder mic into, and went on the air. Two speaker in the ceiling in the hall and another one in our room. We basically had the whole school going for quite a while. The next year, we moved on to the PA system at lunchtime so that we could do real radio sort of into the cafeteria. Then in my junior year, I guess it was, the school started an internship program with area businesses, and one of the internships available was for one of the two local radio stations, and I applied for it along with a whole bunch of other kids, and I got it, and was later told that the reason that I was picked for it was because of my involvement in the school radio station. I never had the heart to tell the teacher that the whole thing was a fake. But that got me started in broadcast radio, in doing radio news, which led me eventually to various radio stations, to a degree in broadcast journalism, Associated Press, CBS News, learning television on the fly, then kind of going backwards into print. So I've covered just about all of the types of media, but it's all based on a hoax.
That is a funny story. Is ham radio as much fun for you now as it was almost 40 years ago?
Absolutely. Maybe even more fun. It's different fun. First of all, the thrill of making contact with somebody in a rare place or breaking through a pile up to a de-expedition or something like that is incomparable. I don't know how to describe it, but it doesn't change from your earliest days on. Your definitions of DX may change, although if you're active on VHF, then you have a different definition of DX than you do on HF. The opportunity to do new things, try new things, and really, you can never run out of things to do and try in ham radio. That's one of the great things about it. Anybody who is bored with ham radio isn't looking hard enough for what they can do in the hobby, because there's always something you haven't tried. Nobody's done everything. There's always something new to try and to be new at again.
Any other memorable experiences you had early on as a ham?
Some mountain topping in VHF contests with friends from my high school radio club. Then one of my friends, when he graduated, went up to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, and invited me to operate the June VHF contest from the top of Mount Greylock. What is now W2SZ, at the time was WA1MUG, was operating, and they were the preeminent VHF contest station in the country at the time. And I remember just being totally amazed, not only with their setup, but it was my introduction to 6 meters, and they were working all over the country on 6 meters. Here I'd been a technician for about a year and was getting pretty discouraged because I had basically talked to all the people within range of my 5-watt AM transmitter on 2 meters. And I was getting a little bored and wondering, gee, is this all there is? And then I went up there and I walked into the 6-meter tent, and they were just working the whole country. And I remember going, wow, I can do this with the license I have. This is amazing. One of the other things that we did, I was mostly working on 2-meter FM, which was new and different at the time. And we were responsible for getting one of the rules changed in the contest. We had up there one of the first synthesized radios, and we were going reverse on repeater pairs in New York City, talking on the repeater output frequency, listening on the input frequency, so that the contacts we made were direct. They were not through the repeater. From Mount Greylock, you had easy coverage throughout the Hudson Valley and Long Island, a lot of Massachusetts, and we just racked up points by going on to the main repeater frequencies in Long Island, New York City, North Jersey, Massachusetts, and working them in reverse. Of course, the next year, there was a change in the rules that said you couldn't use the repeater frequencies at all.
This concludes our first in our monthly series, Ham Radio Roots. We heard Rain's founder-producer Hap Holly, KC9RP, speaking with CQ Magazine editor Rich Moses in W2VU. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2008. Rain, all rights reserved. I'm Byron Lee, KC9EEK, bidding you all a very 73 from all of us at Rain, the Radio Amateur Information Network. www.therainreport.com.